Lord Hope, ladies and gentlemen, some of you will notice that I am not the Lord Chief Justice who was supposed to be chairing this lecture. I apologize for that fact. I'm one of his henchmen. My name's Nicholas Phillips. I'm sitting with him at the moment, and he asked me to convey his apologies. The House of Lords are dealing with the Criminal Justice Bill at the moment, and he felt that he had no alternative but to give that priority. When he asked me to stand in for him, I, in my turn, asked Professor Cranston to send me a CV. I knew that this would be a weighty and impressive document, but was a little surprised when a jiffy bag arrived at home that weighed about 3 kilos. All was explained when I opened it, and found that it also contained a proof of his new work on the principles of banking law, which is about to be published. As the work on this topic to which I am accustomed to resort requires a pantechnicon to transport it, with apologies to one of the editors who's sitting near the back, I was particularly grateful to receive this. And the work is in no other way lightweight. Knowing Ross as I do, I'm quite sure that he didn't send it to me in order for me to give it a plug. And so all that I will say is that I have no doubt that it will be very soon on most of your bookshelves. It is only the latest of an impressive list of books that Professor Cranston has either written or edited, and many of you will be familiar with some, though none of you can possibly be with all, of the many articles he has written on a wide variety of topics, but in particular on banking law. As an expert on banking law, Professor Cranston's services have been sought around the world, and those services have benefited from his expertise. The countries that have benefited from his expertise include Ghana, India, Sri Lanka, Hungary, Mongolia, the Ukraine, and even Bhutan, where I was recently and didn't actually come across anything that suggested that there was the need for his particular expertise in that country. But it is not as a banking lawyer that I have come to know Ross Cranston, but in the context of some of his many other contributions to the world of law. Recently, as a consultant to Lord Wolfe's inquiry into access to justice, and more particularly, and over a more lengthy period, as a most valuable member of the Board of Studies of the Council of Legal Education, which I have chaired over the last 5 years. I haven't yet had occasion to consider an appeal against Mr. Recorder Cranston, and indeed you will agree that such an eventuality is very hard to conceive of. This is an inaugural lecture, somewhat surprisingly perhaps, because Professor Cranston inherited the chair in question some 5 years ago. But his immediate predecessor, who held it for 28 years, apparently confessed to him that he never got round to giving his inaugural lecture at all. So it is relatively early for an inaugural lecture. It is a chair which has been polished by some illustrious predecessors: Gutteridge, Chorley, Gower, and latterly Wedderburn. There is no doubt at all that Professor Cranston adorns it, as did they, and we are very privileged to be present at last for his inaugural lecture.
Lord Justice Phillips, thank you very much for those kind words. I'm especially grateful to you for stepping in at a late hour in the absence of the Lord Chief Justice. If I may say so, it's most appropriate in any event that you should chair this lecture, given your own interest in legal education and your distinguished service as a commercial judge and now on the Court of Appeal. Let me begin, in accordance with what is now best practice in our courts, by identifying as concisely as possible the propositions of fact and law I seek to advance, and where relevant, the grounds being relied upon. The immediate relief I'm seeking is, of course, the speedy conclusion of this lecture. I wish to canvass three themes. Firstly, the centrality of doctrine in understanding the law's operation. Secondly, the obligation we have constantly to pursue the law's renewal, in other words, law reform. And thirdly, that a consideration of the law's context is a fulcrum to a fuller understanding of its operations. These themes are neither original nor new, although in commercial law they haven't been much explored. By commercial law, I mean the law relevant to transactions between professionals and the institutions they use. For my purposes this evening, consumer law isn't part of commercial law, although I'll mention it in passing, together with several other areas of law relevant to commercial transactions. Let me begin then with legal doctrine. I use as a peg the inaugural lecture in 1932 by Theo Chorley, the second Castle professor. In that lecture, Chorley was concerned with the need to keep commercial law up to date by the judges recognizing contemporary commercial practices in the development of legal doctrine, commending in particular the approach of Lord Chief Justice Cockburn in the leading case Goodwin and Roberts about how mercantile usage can render new instruments negotiable. Chorley noted a number of instances where the law in the books was out of kilter with the expectations of the commercial community. Chorley's view, stated subsequently, was that, and I quote, adherence to precedent and legalistic conceptions may distort the law's growth and make it the less able satisfactorily to perform its functions of oiling the machinery of society. Whatever the type of society, be it feudal, capitalist, or socialist, the law should, and in the end will, adapt itself to playing its part in the functioning of the prevailing system. Generally speaking, the discrepancies between commercial law and commercial practice, which Chorley identified, are less pressing than in Chorley's time, for reasons I touch on shortly. That's no reason for complacency. You'll recall that my second theme is to be law reform. But at this point, I wish to concentrate less on the issue that Chorley highlighted and more on the processes by which commercial law has been adjusted to commercial need. Concentrating on these processes uncovers, I'd argue, a great deal, not only about commercial law, but also about the law's operation, which is dealt with neither in the legal textbooks nor in the jurisprudential accounts. As far as judge-made law is concerned, a starting point for this accommodation of commercial law to commercial need, or at least perceived need, has been the objective commercial judges set themselves. It can be traced back to Lord Mansfield, whose approach was actively and explicitly to mould the common law for the general convenience of commerce. This lodestar of commercial utility is echoed in the modern judgments. One passage I hammer home to the undergraduate students in commercial law is from Lord Steyn's judgment in First Energy and Hungarian International Bank. Let me quote one part of it. A theme, said Lord Steyn, that runs through our law of contract is that the reasonable expectations of honest people must be protected. It's not a rule or a principle of law. It's the objective which has been and still is the principal moulding force of our law of contract. It affords no license to a judge to depart from binding precedent. On the other hand, if the prima facie solution to a problem runs counter to the reasonable expectations of honest people, this criterion sometimes requires a vigorous re-examination of the problem to ascertain whether the law does indeed compel demonstrable unfairness. Occasionally, this goal of meeting commercial need will be measured against the approach adopted in other jurisdictions. In a recent decision, Mr. Justice Coleman justified in part the obviously correct conclusion that the rule against penalties has no application to the standard default interest clause in loan agreements in the following terms. It would be highly regrettable, said his lordship, if the English court were to refuse to give effect to such prevalent provisions while the courts of New York are prepared to enforce them. For there to be a disparity between the law applicable in London and New York on this point would be of great disservice to international banking. Commercial need, as objective, is in some respects taken into account in the doctrine itself. Perhaps the best example is the use made of trade usage, in other words, commercial practice. I've already mentioned the way that the law treats as negotiable instruments those regarded as such in the market. These days, that example has little relevance, since paper is increasingly immobilized with custodians, and in some cases completely dematerialized. Nonetheless, it's useful as an illustration. To digress slightly, Lord Chief Justice Cockburn's judgment in Goodwin and Roberts, which I've referred to earlier, was described in 1937 by Lord Atkin as, I quote, that remarkable judgment which is one of the charters of the liberty of the common law. Lord Atkin is one of our great judges, as evidenced by his judgments of Donoghue and Stevenson and Liversidge and Anderson. Not to put too fine a point on it, however, that passage seems a trifle over-enthusiastic. Perhaps it was that Atkin was born and brought up in the heat, humidity, and mosquitoes of Moreton Bay, as was I. Lord Wright's judgment in the Court of Appeal is, in my view, more measured. Both Atkin and Wright were pupils of the great Scruton, of whom more later, and both became law lords, although, like Lord Wolfe, Lord Wright had stepped down in the mid-1930s when he gave that judgment to be Master of the Rolls. Before he took silk, Lord Wright had taught commercial law here at the LSE for some 13 years. He later became an honorary governor of the school. In his early years at the bar, he even considered becoming a full-time law teacher, but was saved from that fate and the relative penury when the work started to flow in. This conscious goal of commercial utility, which I've been outlining, leads to a pragmatic handling of doctrine. Certainly there are some areas relevant to commercial law where the doctrinal concerns still have the upper hand. Constructive trust and tracing are examples. Generally speaking, however, commercial judges are not too concerned with elaborate edifices and fundamental principles where these would prevent the moulding of doctrine to commercial need. Indeed, in some circumstances, doctrine is abandoned altogether. Well known in this regard is Lord Wilberforce's speech in the Eremedon. After giving various examples such as manufacturers' guarantees, bailment, and letters of credit, Lord Wilberforce says, these are all examples which show that English law, having committed itself to a rather technical and schematic doctrine of contract, in application takes a practical approach, often at the cost of forcing the facts to fit uneasily into the market slots of offer, acceptance, and consideration. One of the recurrent essay questions on the undergraduate commercial law paper requires the students to catalogue and to analyse the many examples dealt with in the course illustrating Lord Wilberforce's proposition. And I can see some of them here tonight. One which they must mention if they expect to pass is the problem that the letter of credit contract is not supported by consideration. In his pioneering book on letters of credit, the first Castle professor, H.C. Gutteridge, thought that this pointed to a pressing need to reform the law relating to consideration. In my view, this overlooks what happens in practice. As Professor Roy Good has conceptualized it, the simple fact is that English law enforces a number of abstract payment obligations, of which the letter of credit and the on-demand guarantees are examples. So in this, and in a number of other important areas, English commercial law proceeds pragmatically, if necessary, finessing the conceptual framework and the prerequisites imposed by the textbook writers. Incidentally, Chairman, my students could well add to their catalogue your own recent decision in the Camdex case, where you cut through a great deal of the old learning to hold, correctly in my view, that foreign currency obligations give rise to claims in debt. Only 4 or 5 years ago, the New York Court of Appeals found the old commodity theory of money too beguiling. The result, that a foreign exchange transaction in New York is treated as a sale of goods, lacks intuitive appeal in my view. If the goal is commercial utility, the main vehicle used to reach it is through a respect for the decisions of the parties to a commercial contract, as embodied in their agreement. This respect is manifest in various ways. One is the way in which our courts construe commercial documents. This is often described as the plain meaning rule of interpretation. So stated, it has attracted a good deal of academic criticism. Yet here again, we mustn't overlook what's happening in practice. Last year, the House of Lords considered a reinsurer's liability, where the contract defined the ultimate net loss clause as the sum, the net loss as the sum actually paid by the insurers. The House of Lords held that, in the light of the reinsurance policy as a whole, this phrase, actually paid, could cover claims finally ascertained but not paid. I'm not concerned with the merits of the decision. But if actually paid can mean not actually paid, then surely the critics are missing the target when they inveigh against the literal interpretation rule. In fact, what is happening, as opposed to what is said to be happening, is that commercial documents are construed as far as possible to make commercial sense of the relevant provisions. Having regard to the words used, the remainder of the document, which contains them, and the nature of the transaction. Indeed, the judges will often say explicitly that they're seeking a meaning which makes good commercial sense. There are, of course, limits. In some cases, both sides can plausibly argue that their interpretation will yield a more sensible commercial result. If neither of these interpretations is absurd, then the court cannot be but thrown back on the words used, which is where this misconception about the literal interpretation rule originates. A second way that the courts respect the decisions of the parties, as embodied in the agreement, is through the operation of doctrines relating to matters such as collateral contract, implied terms, and sham. Marketing efforts may, in theory, give rise to a collateral contract, but not as a practical matter in the areas that we're considering. The tests for implied terms are especially onerous, and only exceptionally will one of the parties be able to satisfy them. Likewise with sham, where a party claims that the documents are intended to give the appearance of creating rights and obligations different from those which were intended to be created. Ordinarily, where the revenue laws are not in issue and there is no breach of insider dealing law, money laundering law or the like, the notion of sham has no purchase. And the most the courts will do is to disregard some parts of the documentation if they are clearly inconsistent with other operative parts. Moreover, there's the well-known resistance to equitable intrusions into commercial matters, traceable to the belief, reaffirmed last month by the Privy Council, that if something happens for which a contract has made express provision, the party should know with certainty that the terms will be enforced and not trumped by equity. While doctrines such as undue influence, unconscionability, and conflict of interest arising out of fiduciary relationships have a role to play, where institutions deal with the commercially unsophisticated, the mere possibility that they could apply in the type of commercial transaction I'm concerned with could create uncertainty by enabling them to be employed as a negotiating tactic. So far, I've spoken about the doctrine as handled by the courts, but this is only part of the story. Important areas of commercial law rarely see the light of day in the courts. Every week, there are tens of thousands of derivatives transactions involving enormous sums of money, but litigation's a rarity. Mr. Justice Mance's clear decision in the Bankers Trust and Dalmala case last year, which gave effect to the approach I've been speaking about, should ensure that this remains the case. Even if matters are litigated, focusing on the decision alone misses their impact, which, if commercially unacceptable, is quickly mitigated by lawyers redrafting documents, restructuring transactions, and in some cases inventing new legal institutions. In all these activities, the reality is of practicing commercial lawyers using law as a malleable resource. They are not devoted to the purity of the law or to its rational development, but to using it instrumentally to achieve their clients' ends. Innovation and boldness with regard to legal doctrine are the hallmarks of practicing commercial lawyers. But all this activity occurs hidden from the public gaze. I've been fortunate to see some of it in practice. But there's too little systematic knowledge amongst academics of the role which practicing commercial lawyers play, and in particular how they use legal doctrine. A limited amount of information can be gleaned from the books on matters like drafting and negotiation, published for training purposes, and from the manuals available to assist practicing lawyers. Some information is also available in historical studies, such as Professor Cornish's Law and Society in England, and in the growing number of histories of the eminent city law firms. A recent ethnographic study of commercial lawyers contains some fascinating details on how they negotiate on behalf of their respective clients in drafting contracts, although it doesn't do justice, in my view, to the legal doctrines lurking in the shadows of these activities. The dominant themes to emerge from these various studies and from casual observation is one of creative lawyering. Commercial lawyers invent legal devices, draft documents, and maneuver around doctrine to oil the wheels of commerce. They manipulate and mold legal concepts to protect their clients' business activity. It's one aspect of what is sometimes described as private lawmaking. The scope and flexibility which commercial lawyers have varies, of course, with the subject matter. But this capacity to form and reformulate concepts is at the base of commercial law. In some cases, the bold device will need the court's approval to be effective. But note how it happens. The practicing commercial lawyers are the initial creative element, reacting to the needs of their clients. The courts then respond to the devices which the lawyers develop, approving them with or without qualifications. Practicing commercial lawyers also manipulate language as well as legal concepts. Legal language has a value, even if it's not used entirely accurately. Lay people can be influenced in their behaviour because they believe, perhaps wrongly, that certain consequences follow. Courts too may be swayed by a bold, although imprecise, use of language. Professor Carl Llewellyn, possibly the leading American commercial lawyer of the century and a catalyst for the Uniform Commercial Code in the United States, wrote of this use of language in commercial law, and I quote, "New words and labelings, which are things of guile, are far from being reliable before a case law court, and a lawyer would be a fool who trusted wholly to them. But a moderately pure transaction's strength is as the strength of a much purer one if its words and its labelings bear the mark of legal artistry rather than of stupidity or artifice." So my first theme can be summarized in these terms. Those seeking to understand the role of commercial law won't get very far without an appreciation, at least in broad outline, of the doctrinal law, for this contains the categories which lawyers invent and which are constitutive of practicing institutions. But it's doctrine as process to achieve objectives, the overarching objective being to facilitate commercial needs. Before moving away from this first theme, there are three ancillary points I want to make. The first is that my focus, as I've indicated, is one of focusing on commercial litigation and transactions, the type of litigation handled in the commercial court and by the commodity and insurance arbitrators, who still do a good deal of international work in London, and the type of transactional work and litigation undertaken by the large city law firms. In other words, this is commercial work where the parties are fairly evenly balanced, or if they're not, have the capacity to employ legal services so that both sides are evenly matched. The normative conclusions that might be drawn about the legal processes I've been describing are not necessarily appropriate when we move from that end of the spectrum to other types of commercial transaction, less still to consumer transactions. Yet historically this was done. In a classic case, Miss Lestrange, as she was no doubt called in Llandudno, where she owned a cafe, entered into a contract with a supplier of cigarette machines. And Lord Justice Scruton, mentioned earlier, treated the contract as if it were a charter party. She was bound to the contract she'd signed, unread. That approach, as the critics of adhesion contracts have long pointed out, is hardly appropriate. As Professor Francis Reynolds suggested several years ago, our contract law, evolved out of the type of commercial cases which I've been describing, may not provide the appropriate approach, for example, for the county court judges who, because of the jurisdictional limits, now try smaller commercial matters. And it's quite unsuited to consumer disputes. Despite some statutory intervention, we need, as my colleague Professor Hugh Collins has argued, to build doctrinal law for these transactions based not so much on values such as freedom and market, but more on values such as trust, fairness, and cooperation. My second ancillary point concerns procedure. Lord Wright once said that the accidents of procedure lead to the doctrines and rules of English law. Yet in our law schools, procedure is frequently a Cinderella subject. In an article in 1949, the Second Castle professor, Lord Chorley, expressed his dismal reflections on the lack of interest in procedure and argued for a chair of procedure. His successor, Professor Jim Gower, sought to infuse some academic life into the subject. Fortunately, in this department, as well as Professor Michael Zander, we now have Joe Jacob working on this vitally important area of civil procedure. The third ancillary matter concerns legal ethics and professional responsibility. One of the most influential books published in the United States in recent times has been The Lost Lawyer by Anthony Cronman, Dean of the Yale Law School. Cronman argues that the American legal profession faces a crisis of morale, a spiritual crisis, which strikes at the heart of their professional pride. In the old days, he argues, the role of the lawyer involved compassion for the client's entire predicament, detachment, and a concern for the public good. Nowadays, the economic view of the law is in the ascendancy, he says. There's a decline in the self-image of a healing profession, and the lawyer has become too much caught up in the client's speculation. Although I've hardly done justice to the depth and subtlety of Cronman's account, one must, to an extent, discount the argument. Were the good old days so good, for example? Commercial law, as I've just indicated, was hardly kind to those without economic clout. Yet Cronman has a point. In the commercial field, lawyers, especially younger lawyers, can be put under great pressure to accommodate their clients' interests. Competition is now so fierce that there may be a temptation to do what the client wants, regardless of other factors. The point emerged starkly in the report on the House of Fraser takeover, where the inspectors, one of whom was Lord Justice Brooke, concluded that the leading firm of city solicitors advising the bidders had not appreciated the dangers in advocacy of identifying too closely with their client's cause. In more general terms, there's a public interest boundary to lawyers' zeal. I've written elsewhere about the need for the profession's codes of conduct to refine this for the guidance of everyday practice. That leads me conveniently to my next theme, law reform, which is a hallmark of a public-spirited profession and which is a thread running through the history of law here at the LSE. Perhaps the Third Castle professor, Jim Gower, has the most impressive law reform credentials. He was a member of the Jenkins Committee on Company Law Reform. His company's code for Ghana became a reference point in the following decades for proposals to amend companies' legislation in the common law world. On his return from Africa, he became a law commissioner. And then in 1981, when others of his age would have been decently retired, he was entrusted with the task of reviewing statutory protection for investors in Britain. As a result, Britain adopted a new and elaborate regime for securities regulation, a subject which my colleague Julia Black has made her own. My colleagues Judith Friedman and Vanessa Finch are active in company law reform. Judith's recent paper on reforming company law provides a brilliant framework for what needs to be done there. Much law reform in the commercial area is affected by the courts themselves. The following ditty is attributed to Carl Llewellyn. Some say our law is in a sorry plight, and a folly its fruition. The answer is to set it right in the common law tradition. However, a court's scope for law reform is limited. It's limited by the need to address the particular case, which will often be fact-based, involving the construction of standard form documents, or be an appeal from arbitrators. Moreover, as I suggested earlier, there are whole areas of commercial law which don't surface in the courts, but which are troubling in their application to modern commercial transactions. Security is one of these. Technological change has also raised new issues, such as the dematerialization of securities to which I referred earlier. Indeed, in recent times, the Financial Law Panel has identified a range of commercial law matters involving legal uncertainty. It seems to me that at the end of the day, in some of these areas, legislative action is not only necessary but desirable. Even the most creative of practicing commercial lawyers, such as my friend Philip Wood, can't overcome all the problems thrown up by the new demands and practices. Any such legislative intrusion must, however, in my view, the first principle is summed up in Otto Kahn-Freund's memorable phrase that the lawyer must not go around legal technique, but through it to the law's reform and to the law's policies. Kahn-Freund was perhaps the greatest figure so far in the history of law at the school, and through wartime exigencies was for a time required to teach the whole range of commercial law subjects. One corollary of his aphorism is that reform should build on the rich texture of existing rules and also be rule-based. Personally speaking, I'm not convinced that introducing a notion like good faith without more will achieve a great deal in the commercial context or even in the consumer context. It seems to me better in the commercial context to build on standards which already have some grounding in the law and are less open textured, such as the standards, at least in the investor protection area, of due diligence and unsuitability. In the consumer area, a more rule-based approach than that contained in the Unfair Terms in Consumer Contracts Directive seems to be more likely to produce the intended result. There are informal codes, including those drawn up by the textbook writers such as Bosted and Reynolds on agency. There's the great experience of other common law jurisdictions. And there are those measures at the international level which have a considerable head of steam, such as some of the efforts of UNIDROIT and the ICC. This leads me to a second principle for commercial law reform, that the comparative method provides a valuable tool. To put it at its lowest, we can learn from the mistakes of others. More generously, no one country has a monopoly of wisdom, and we can learn how comparable jurisdictions have addressed the problems that we may face. Codification has a role, and my friend and mentor Roy Good has argued the case for codification most persuasively. There's little I can add to his analysis, except that in my own law reform experience in Central Europe, Africa and Asia, it would have been easier to sell English law principles if I'd been able to pull a copy of the English Commercial Code out of my back pocket. Interestingly, Jim Gower recommended a company's code for Ghana because it was impractical, as he put it, to saddle Ghana with a Companies Act which was only intelligible in the light of foreign decisions extending back over a century or more. The third principle of law reform is that reform efforts shouldn't be confined to lawyers' law, in other words, to the technical rules of law. In Gower's powerful argument, lawyers should also be implicated in the efforts to adapt law so that it fosters the social and economic life of the community. if I may be permitted to draw on my own experiences in Hungary. Reforming the banking law there couldn't neglect that the new law had symbolic functions, both for foreign banks and also, in particular, to send a message to the new financial entrepreneurs in Hungary that the market system didn't mean unbridled financial activity at the expense of the many, a lesson, unfortunately, not learnt in Albania. It was also necessary in formulating the Hungarian banking law to take into account the constitutional position, thus the wide discretion that we would normally entrust to bank regulators was anathema to the newly appointed Hungarian bank regulators, since they had experienced the undesirable consequences of unbridled state discretion for some 40 years. Finally, essential to law reform is that there be machinery in place to review the existing law, to make proposals for reform, and to monitor implementation. Systematic law reform is especially necessary with commercial law, which, as I've indicated, is built up empirically and pragmatically, and thus may lack consistency. The Law Commission does good work, although the division between commercial law reform entrusted to the Commission and that retained within the DTI is sometimes a puzzle to the outsider. I've already mentioned the Financial Law Panel. It seems to me that a coordination of these and other efforts is necessary. My third theme concerns the importance of the law's context to its understanding. Conceptual manipulation, orderly reasoning, and legal discovery are not enough. For a true understanding, one must have regard to the cultural history of the law, its institutional setting, and how the law actually impacts. That understanding, I would argue, can come from many sources: theoretical inquiry, a drawing on other disciplines, empirical investigation, as well as from a fairly pragmatic consideration of the law's setting. There's nothing new in this argument. For many years, there have been urgings of a broader perspective. One can go back, for example, to the Treatise on the Study of Law in 1797, where logic and history are strongly recommended as background for the lawyer. The sparks of all sciences are raked up in the ashes of the law, as another source of that time put it. A lawyer, it concluded, needed a smattering of them all, as well as a knowledge of history, natural law, and civil law. However, it'd be wrong to give the impression that this broader view has always been shared. Its wide acceptance these days has required considerable struggle. Many of you will know of Lord Justice Scruton's rebuke to Mr. Justice McCarty in the so-called Helen of Troy case, that, and I quote, "the less sociological knowledge that is brought into the discussion of these questions, the better." The decision in that case, Place and Searle, concerned what to our postmodern ears was a rather quaint action by a grocer's assistant against a medical practitioner for enticement. Mr. Justice McCarty had noted that the wife was thoroughly unhappy with her husband, had held that the words, "Come on, Gwen, we will go," were not sufficient evidence of enticement, and had commented generally on the changing role of women in society. The Court of Appeal would have none of it. Lord Justice Scruton, with Lord Justices Greer and Slessor, the latter, of course, a former lecturer in industrial law at this school, held that the judge had been wrong. There was evidence on which a jury, properly directed, could reasonably find for the plaintiff. Of course, Scruton is generally acknowledged to be one of our great commercial judges, a reputation which travelled beyond these shores, as evidenced by Carl Llewellyn's eulogy, a trifle embarrassing, in the pages of the Columbia Law Review in 1936. Early in his career, Scruton had been a professor of constitutional law and legal history at one of our sister colleges in the University of London, located somewhere in Bloomsbury. But his reputation was made at the commercial bar, in a variety of publications, and in his work as a judge. Llewellyn regarded Scruton's commercial judgments as unsurpassed, although I'm not always sure he had the better argument in his well-publicised clashes with the House of Lords. What can be said is that he had an immensely powerful intellect and that in the Mansfield tradition, he constantly strove to adjust our commercial law to the needs of the business community. Moreover, my immediate predecessor in this chair, Bill Wedderburn, reminded us in his centenary lecture last year of Scruton's own remarkable lecture in 1925, when Scruton had said that impartiality, while relatively easy in the commercial court, was much more difficult to attain between disputants, one of your own class and one not of your own class. Lord Wedderburn notes that Lasky, the focus of his, Wedderburn's lecture, didn't make a parallel analysis of common law until 15 years later. This law in context approach has been the hallmark of law at the LSE, shared by the commercial lawyers. Lord Wright, so closely associated with the beginnings of commercial law here, wrote of how the commercial judges must have this broader appreciation of their decision making. It is true, he said, that they can now proceed on the basis of decided cases. But if new problems arise, they have still to decide them by a careful consideration of the business realities. And in construing contracts, they have to remember the habits of thought and expression of businessmen, as well as the special exigencies and conditions of the particular business. One way of placing the law in context, as I said earlier, is to draw on the insights of other disciplines. There's much exciting legal scholarship which uses the insights of anthropology, textual analysis, and social theory. Another way of placing the law in context is through empirical work. In my own view, there's a great need for more empirical inquiry. If I may be permitted to change tack slightly, the point came home recently when I worked with Lord Wolfe on his Access to Justice inquiry, where we confronted a paucity of basic information. In this country, very little money has been spent on understanding the civil justice process. There's nothing comparable to the empirical studies elsewhere of delay and efficiency in civil litigation. A third way that law can be placed in context is through what can be described as atheoretical eclecticism. Any indictment brought against me in this regard would contain numerous counts. History, the social sciences, and casual observation have all been mined for insights into the law, in what, to the purist, is no doubt an irritatingly unsystematic way. Let me illustrate by two examples drawn from banking law. The first originates in the casual observation that banks these days are typically multifunctional institutions with international operations. Many existing books on banking law are generally rooted in domestic retail banking. They focus on matters such as the banker-customer relationship, bank accounts, retail payments. Excellent though some of these books may be, they paint only part of the picture. Those wanting to see the whole canvas must take the standpoint of the multifunctional bank. The emergence of the multifunctional bank raises a variety of legal issues. Let me mention three. Prominent is the issue of controlling risk, as core banking is combined with other financial activities. It is this concern which prompted the separation of core banking from securities activities in the United States in the famous Glass-Steagall Act, a separation which is now breaking down. A variety of regulatory steps have been taken in many jurisdictions which seek to address this concern. Capital adequacy requirements, consolidated supervision, encouraging the institutions themselves to adopt sophisticated risk management models, and so on. Second, there's the concentration of economic power in the multifunctional bank and the competition and antitrust concerns associated with this. What is at first glance surprising is that so few mergers and acquisitions of banks have fallen into the commercial law net. Into the competition law net, as my colleague Peter Marcinski sets out in his seminal book on multinational enterprises and the law. Moreover, the social and economic consequences of the mergers and acquisitions which have created the multifunctional bank have not been addressed. these concerns were addressed in an earlier period by Justice Brandeis in his book Other People's Money and How the Bankers Use It. A third issue concerns the conflicts of interest thrown up in the operation of the multifunctional bank. Legally relevant are provisions in the general and the regulatory law. In the general law, the most obvious prescriptions against conflicts of interest are from the fiduciary law. But the difficulties in applying fiduciary law to multifunctional banks are both conceptual and institutional. Conceptually, there must be a fiduciary relationship before equity intervenes to prevent or to remedy a conflict of interest. While the trustee beneficiary and the agent principal relationships give rise to fiduciary obligations, there's a reluctance, to which I referred earlier, to impose fiduciary obligations in other commercial relationships. Institutionally, the problem is that fiduciary law developed at a time when organisations were relatively simple. Its application to the multifunctional bank is not an easy matter. One problem is knowledge. Can the knowledge of different parts of a multifunctional bank be attributed to the business as a whole? Even if one part doesn't know, in fact, what another part knows, especially if there are barriers such as Chinese walls which prevent the free flow of information. I raise these technical issues in what's designed to be a general lecture to illustrate my point that context is all important. Once we see the context of the modern bank, we're forced to confront difficult legal issues which haven't been systematically dealt with before. Another dimension to law in context is the use of constructs to eliminate and to explicate legal relationships. I've used the construct of networks in some of my own work in banking law to address the various ways in which banks relate to each other. Thus, the network of contracts between banks takes various forms. First, contracts might be part of a chain, as in payment. Secondly, the concept of network covers bilateral transactions between banks, a transfer of funds, a deposit on the interbank market, a swap, a sale of loan assets, and so on. These transactions may be made against the backdrop of a long-standing arrangement or master agreement, or on the basis of standard form contracts prepared by an association of financial institutions, or in accordance with the rules of an exchange or a clearing system through which the relevant transactions are routed. Thirdly, the concept of network can be applied to contracts which are bundled, as in a bank syndicate, where a number of banks join in financing a particular enterprise or project. Now, the concept of network has been invoked in a variety of ways. Some have argued that it can overcome certain conceptual difficulties in the law, such as privity of contract. Their argument is, in a way, for a type of organisational liability. Others have analysed networks from the angle of economic efficiency. In particular circumstances, a network of contracts will minimise transaction costs and maximise flexibility, thus offering real advantages to banks and their customers. Yet others have used the concept of network to theorise about systems. Do networks stand between contract and organisation, or are they a higher order system, as my colleague Gunter Teubner has explored? I can't do justice to all these issues in this lecture, but let me mention two specific points. Let me touch on the issue of network liability. As I mentioned, banks use other banks, for example, to affect a customer's payment instructions. The relationship between a bank and its correspondent banks is often one of agency, insofar as it brings the issuing bank and beneficiary into contractual relations. For example, a correspondent acting as an advising bank in a documentary credit transaction seems to be an agent, but not always, and the correspondent may only be an independent contractor providing services for reward, such as conveying messages. An important legal issue is whether, in the event of a correspondent bank's error, the customer can sue either the bank or the correspondent. For example, if a customer's payment instructions are carried out incorrectly by the correspondent, can the customer recover lost interest or in some cases the sum itself if it's being paid away to a fraudster. More significantly, can the customer recover consequential losses, such as an adverse movement in exchange rates? In some cases, the consequential losses can be very significant. For example, a correspondent doesn't pay a sum in time, and as a result, a bidder doesn't clinch a corporate takeover, and thus misses the considerable profits which were reasonably to be expected. As far as the customer's bank is concerned, it's obliged strictly to observe its mandate. No breach of this occurs where the error can be laid at the correspondent's door. Nor, generally speaking, will the customer's bank be in a breach of its duty of performance. In the main, it will not be giving an absolute undertaking that a particular result will be achieved. Rather, it'll be bound at most to exercise reasonable care and skill. That it must do in choosing and possibly also supervising the correspondent bank. But if it selects a reputable bank, it's difficult to conceive of a successful claim. In particular circumstances, the nature of its contract with the customer will mean that the correspondence lapses can be sheeted home to it. But given the underdeveloped state of our English law of sub-agency, it goes too far to suggest, as some have, that as a general rule, a bank is vicariously liable for the acts of its correspondents, or that it undertakes that its correspondents will perform their tasks adequately. What of a claim by the customer directly against the correspondent? Some civil law systems permit claims by customers who can be said to be third-party beneficiaries of a contract between their bank and the correspondent. English law still adheres to a strict doctrine of privity of contract. It's unlikely in the ordinary case that the customer's bank as agent creates privity between the customer and the correspondent. Legislation is making some inroads into these common law principles. The European Commission Directive on Cross-Border Payments, which has just been published in the Official Journal, imposes liability on a customer's bank for credit transfers which are not completed. Liability is strict. The customer's bank can, in turn, claim from its correspondent. I succeed as Castle Professor the outstanding figures who have held the chair since 1920, Professors Guttridge, Chorley, Gower and Wedderburn. I've also joined a long tradition of commercial law studies here at the LSE. Commercial law was taught, as I said, from the school's foundation. A range of notable lawyers have been involved over the last century. As well as the Castle Professors, they include Lord Gough, Professors Cornish, Diamond and Trittle, and Lord Irving. Sir Otto Kahn Freund once said, and I quote, "Commercial law was, I think, of central importance for the development of legal studies in this country, and for the particular part the LSE was destined to play in that development." He went on to refer to the specialisation of commercial law along functional rather than conceptual lines, which he said was a conspicuous contribution the LSE has made and obviously continues to make to the treatment of law in terms of its social purpose. Commercial law at the LSE has come a long way in the last century. The range of subjects, the volume of law to be digested, have all expanded enormously. Yet in many ways, the concerns remain the same. Explicating the law relevant to commercial transactions and organisations, identifying the rules and procedures which require reform in the light of social and economic needs, and exploring the law's operation in practice and how it's moulded by social and economic imperatives. The case of commercial law demonstrates how, to return again to Kahn Freund, one of the lasting achievements of the school with law generally has been its study as a social force, without neglecting its role as an intellectual and professional technique. Lord Justice Phillips, I finish where I began, with the practice directions which now govern our courts. They demand a strict compliance with time limits, and under them specified periods are only exceptionally extended. My allotted time has elapsed. Thank you.
we're all honest people, and our reasonable expectations this evening were very high. Ross Cranston has met those expectations. He's given us a brilliant and unconventional, and for my part, very sympathetic insight into commercial law. That's not to say he may not also have given us a thirst, and if he has, that can be refreshed, he asked me to say, in the senior common room, I think on the floor above. Is it? Thank you very much.